number 075063, the American Council of the Blind et al., Henry N. Paulson, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury of Congress. Mr. Cohn, the accountant, Mr. Rivera, Mr. Estrella, Mr. Levicki, the applicant.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Jonathan Cohn representing the United States of America. In this extraordinary case, Your Honors, plaintiffs contend that the United States currency is unlawful, and they seek nothing less than to force its redesign under the supervision of the District Court, a remedy that would be inconsistent with the long history of our currency, with the discretion that Congress vested and the Treasury Secretary to design the currency, and most importantly, for purposes of this appeal, with the terms of the Rehabilitation Act itself as construed by the Supreme Court.
What is your understanding of the controlling question of law that we are to decide that will somehow expedite the district court proceeding?
Your Honor, there are two controlling questions of law here. One, more narrowly, is the question of whether the Rehabilitation Act requires unassisted access. And second, more generally, whether the blind have meaningful access to the currency. Both questions are controlling, and with respect, the court should reach them and not remit.
That's just part of the inquiry under the Rehab Act, whether it's violated or not, requires the answer to two questions, right? The meaningful access question and the undue burden question. You suggested that we're only looking at the meaningful access question.
With respect, this court has both issues before it. Right. And arguably, the undue burden question is also a controlling question of law. But with respect, the court need not reach that issue because the meaningful access issue alone is sufficient to reverse the district court. Once this court concludes, as it should, that the blind have meaningful access to the currency, that's the end of the case, and there's no need to address.
I don't understand that phrase. I don't understand how that phrase applies. I know the Supreme Court used it in, Alexander?
Alexander versus Choate, yes, Your Honor.
But it was dicta, because the Supreme Court didn't decide that disparate treatment would give rise. It said, assuming it did, it wouldn't in this case. And when you talk about access, you're talking about going into or exiting or something. So what does that mean? I don't think we're talking about a currency transaction.
It's a perplexing question, Your Honor. You're absolutely right. This whole case is about trying to shove a square peg into a round hole. It's utterly unclear whether the Rehabilitation Act applies at all in this context. I mean, Congress surely in 1973 had no idea that it was going to be used for a context like this one. I mean, if you look at the
The meaningful part?
Meaningful, assuming that we try to treat this case as a meaningful access case, guidance comes from the Ninth Circuit's decision in Byrd versus Lewis and Clark, in which the question is, is he able to obtain many of the benefits of the program? It's okay if some aspects of the program are inaccessible, as long as many of the benefits are obtainable. On the whole, is the disabled able to get ready access?
I can understand it if it was framed up in terms, the statute doesn't use the term meaningful access, doesn't use the term undue burden or any other weasel word that may put in there. But I can understand if the question is, are people who are blind or visually impaired denied the opportunity to use currency? That question is, I can understand that question, but the meaningful access to, I don't get.
Yeah, it really doesn't make sense, and that's because, again, this case is all about the square peg in the round hole. I mean, the Rehabilitation Act at bottom is about discrimination, and the government here is not discriminating against the blind. The blind and the sighted alike.
Well, the Supreme Court has said, we're not talking about intentional motive, but thoughtlessness.
Correct, Your Honor. In Alexander, the court assumed that the Rehabilitation Act addressed disparate impact.
Didn't decide it, though.
Didn't decide it, just assumed it. And
so you mean absent the Secretary of the Treasury saying, I hereby decide that we are going to issue currency that discriminates against the blind?
Your Honor.
That there is no evidence?
Your Honor, we're not making that argument here. We're willing
to
assume.
Your point here, when you say people can use the currency.
Your Honor, we're willing to assume arguendo, as the Supreme Court did in Alexander, as this court did in Moderno, that disparate impact claims are covered. But at bottom, we have to follow the Supreme Court's guidance, which is the Rehab Act does not require equal results. And all this court should be looking for, if anything, under the meaningful access inquiry, is whether the blind are able to obtain many of the benefits of using the currency. And in fact, there.
So let me be clear. If a person is in a wheelchair and somebody can lift him up from the street onto the sidewalk, then he has meaningful use of the sidewalk.
Your Honor,
is that the government's position?
With respect, Your Honor, no, it's not our position.
Right.
You're assuming that disparate impact, I mean, it's not an issue, right? You're
exactly.
Assuming that disparate impact can
absolutely, Your Honor. For purposes of this appeal, we are assuming that disparate impact claims are covered, but the example you give actually highlights why this is not a violation of the Rehabilitation Act. In that case, you're expecting some third party to engage in physical labor to lift the blind person over the curb or up the steps. In this case, all we're talking about, the only assistance, for lack of a better word, that a third party must give the blind is not stealing from the blind, not cheating from the blind, not engaging.
If a person says, I have some paper currency in my hand, what denomination is it? Now you're saying the mental process that a third person has to engage in is not activity?
Your Honor, all I'm saying is the third party is not required to engage in any physical assistance. All we're expecting a third party to do is...
physical is the key word here?
Your Honor, what's going on here is a far cry from the typical disparate impact Rehabilitation Act case involving, for instance, inaccessibility to a courthouse. If there are only stairs to get to this courtroom...
But the same argument could have been made as to the deaf prisoner.
The what prisoners?
The prisoner who needed an interpreter.
I'm not sure if I follow the case, the prisoner needing the interpreter.
You're saying things are physical here. You're making that distinction. And I'm saying, well, courts have, circuits have looked at it to go beyond mere physical bars.
Your Honor, I'm not saying it's only physical. All I'm saying is, by contrast to that quintessential case involving the Rehabilitation Act and a violation, what we have here, the only assistance that we're expecting anyone to give is not lie and cheat and steal. And, Your Honor,
is
not lying and cheating and stealing from the blind. That's the only assistance we're expecting.
You recognize that is a problem, right? I mean, that's a significant problem with a blind, visually impaired person using the paper currency as it exists now. You're not discounting that, are you?
Your Honor, it's a physical obstacle, but as the record in this case confirms, the blind are able to use the currency all the time. And as the National Federation of the Blind established in their brief very clearly, the blind spend their cash just as easily as the sighted person. They're able to use the currency successfully, and they do not encounter significant barriers. Your Honor, let's look at the record in this case, because this case could be a bit more challenging for us if there was rampant evidence of fraud. If the third parties were frequently lying and cheating and stealing from the blind, duping them, saying a $1 bill is a $20 bill.
Congress had in mind that there would have to be evidence of criminal activity in order for the statute to apply?
That's clearly not my point, Your Honor. What I'm trying to suggest here, Your Honor.
I want you to understand the implications of your point.
I'm not sure that's an implication of my point, with all due respect. What I'm saying here is that you're suggesting there is assistance that's required from third parties. What I'm saying is, if you want to call it assistance, that's fine, but all that's being expected from third parties is not lying and cheating, and is just not cheating the blind. And if you look at this record, there's almost no evidence the blind are defrauded. The 30B6 witness.
In other words, I thought your response to Judge Griffith, maybe I misunderstood what you said, was that where the government has a program that is premised on the ability to see in order to distinguish between denominations of currency, that there could be a situation in which there would be a disparate impact where blind persons also are entitled to access or use of that program in order to be full participants in our civil society.
And the blind do have meaningful access to the currency. They use the currency all the time.
But why isn't the government willing to concede that if a program is premised on the ability to see, if you can't see, then the program is not accessible to you?
The program is not premised on the ability to see. A dollar in the hands of a blind person is worth just the same as a dollar in the hands of a sighted person.
How can the blind person use the currency in the same way that you can?
The Rehabilitation Act does not require the use to be the same or comparable as cases like Byrd and Jones and the voting cases all established.
The government has made this decision that our currency is going to include paper currency.
It does include paper currency.
So the blind aren't trying to argue that they want a different program. They're saying they want to be able to use the current program.
Correct. And the question of the Rehabilitation Act is whether or not they have meaningful access to that program. And they do.
If you can't see something, and the program assumes you can see, you still have meaningful access?
The program does not assume you can see, and the blind do have meaningful access because they use the currency all the time, frequently, and they're very seldom defrauded again.
There are dozens, hundreds, thousands of government programs that are in writing. The briefs that were filed in this court were in writing. The websites of every major federal government agency is in writing. If you're blind, one of the arguments is where does this stop? Does that mean that every single federal government program that's a website or the post office? The Rehabilitation Act applies to the post office.
Yes.
A common occurrence is that a delivery is attempted to be made at your residence, and you're not there, and you have to sign for it. And a note is handwritten out in a form and pasted on your door. Is that program illegal? That's the argument, isn't it? All these programs are therefore violations of the Rehabilitation Act.
You're absolutely right. Under the logic spelled out by Judge Rogers, those all would be violations of the Rehabilitation Act. And clearly that's not what Congress intended. And the Supreme Court in Alexander versus Choate made very clear it wanted to keep the act within manageable bounds.
The Supreme Court talks about these two conflicting goals, and in discussions with my colleagues, I gather you thought we should only decide the, quote, access, quote, issue.
Your Honor.
So on postage, let's be clear. Does postage have the same currency as paper currency?
I'm not sure if I follow the question, but you don't have tactile features on postage stamps, for instance. And just looking at this record, Your Honor, this case arguably would be more difficult, although we'd still say the government should prevail, if there was rampant evidence of fraud against the blind. But the record actually shows the exact opposite. Plaintiff's own 30B6 witness testified that although she's been blind her entire life, not once has she been successfully defrauded. The two named plaintiffs, similar results. One's been blind his entire life, been defrauded only once. The other one has been blind for much of his life, and over the past 20 years, defrauded only a handful of times. If there was more evidence of fraud, this might be a closer case, and many of the points
you
made would.
That's why I'm back to, so there has to be evidence of criminal activity.
That
was what Congress contemplated, that the statute would not apply if I can successfully maneuver my way around fraud, but I actually have to be the victim of fraud in order for the statute to apply?
Your Honor, I'm not making a criminal versus civil distinction.
You keep coming back to there's no evidence of fraud here.
Well, the point I'm making, Your Honor, is quite simple. The blind have meaningful access to the currency because they're able to use the currency all the time.
Because they rely on the kindness of strangers, someone has said in their brief. I mean, is that the government's best response?
Well, we have several responses, Your Honor. We think they're all quite good with all due respect. Our first point, Your Honor, is that the Rehabilitation Act does not require unassisted access, as many other courts have recognized. And that by itself is grounds for reversing the district court, which...
No, I think that you make a good point on that issue. But I don't think that necessarily responds entirely. I mean, because at least the other circuits have said the obligation is on the government to make the program accessible.
Well, let's look at the decisions of other circuits, because those cases highlight why this decision below should be reversed. In those cases, like Byrd and Jones and Rodriguez, the plaintiffs had far less access to the program at issue than the blind have to the currency. Let's first look at the Byrd case in the Ninth Circuit. That involved a student on a study abroad program, and she was unable to leave her dorm in Sydney without the assistance of her fellow students. She couldn't use the bathroom without assistance. She could not engage in many of the outdoor activities at all because of her disability. Nonetheless, the Ninth Circuit held there was meaningful access because, by and large, she was able to obtain many of the benefits of the program, even though some aspects were unavailable. Jones is very similar. That's the Sixth Circuit case involving the parking lot that was a couple blocks away, and the plaintiff with MS was unable to walk that distance, so she wanted to have parking right next to her office, and the court said, no, the Rehabilitation Act doesn't require that. We understand.
These cases are difficult to draw analogies from, but I wanted, before you sit down, I'm just concerned about the procedural posture of this case as it reaches us. And in the opinion that Judge Robertson issued, he said that there are several potential accommodations that have been put forth, and they're reasonable on their face. I don't know what that means.
I'm not sure I understand.
What do you think it means?
I'm not quite sure I understand that either. I think maybe he was just talking that looking at the expense alone, it's not unreasonable, but that's a very incomplete analysis.
I don't know how he can grant summary judgment without making a judgment about the particular accommodation or the particular change in the way that we use currency, and evaluating that, number one, to see whether it would be effective, number two, what the cost would be in terms of the useful life, not only of the, or putting the, you know, the new dyes or whatever they use, useful life. So I don't know that I see that sort of a judgment here. I mean, we could decide this case, for example, we could decide this case on the basis that, yeah, assuming there's meaningful access, that the burden is too great.
Right? That's correct, Your Honor.
But we're deprived of that opportunity if the only issue before us is the meaningful access part of this thing.
Oh, both are before you, because even if the only controlling question of law is meaningful access, under cases like Yamaha or Philip Morris, the entire order is before this court. So this court could address this case on the undue burden prong.
I don't see any statement by Judge Robertson about the costs imposed on the private sector. Did the government argue and put forth evidence that regarding the costs on the private sector, the vending machines and so on?
We did present that argument. I believe he has a footnote that discounts that because he notes that the survey conducted by NAMA did not take into account the fact that the $1 bill needs to be changed. But that is a very significant cost in addition to whatever cost the government bears. And with respect to Judge Robertson, he should not have overlooked it so quickly.
But you made a number of arguments on undue burden, didn't you?
We did, Your Honor.
And they were rejected.
That's right, Your Honor.
And you simply take issue with the conclusion. You don't take issue with the fact that you were allowed to make the arguments. You
That's
just take
correct.
Issue with whether they were sufficiently persuasive or not. Judge Robertson found them not to be.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, this court, although it could decide this case an undue burden, it doesn't have to. It could decide this case solely upon meaningful access. The blind have meaningful access to the currency.
And what could we find that that we're persuaded by the there's not meaningful access? What would we do then?
If this court concludes that there's not meaningful access, then this court should still reverse the district court on the basis of undue burden. As Judge Randolph was pointing out, there's a significant burden not just to the government economically, not just to the vending machines industries, but also there's a burden in terms of how do we then design the currency. If you look at a $10 bill, for instance, there's a lot going on in terms of
But didn't you make all those arguments, and Judge Robertson said he wasn't persuaded, that he couldn't find in any of the proposals that you put forward and that you supported with all the evidence that you had amassed, that he could that all of them were sufficient. None of them posed an undue burden.
But with respect, that's why there are appellate courts, Your Honor, because the district court just erred. But again, there's no reason for this court to grapple with the undue burden issue. The court should reverse if it reaches it, but the much more straightforward basis for reversing the decision below is on meaningful access.
Let's talk about
summary judgment and Judge Robertson saying, well, the survey wasn't extensive enough, and there's a dispute about this, and there's a dispute about that, and so on and so forth. Yet he issues summary judgment on the basis that there are no material facts in dispute. But he's identified a whole series of factual disputes, which is why I find it confusing.
Absolutely, and that's why he erred. That's one of the many reasons why his decision below was erroneous. And the court could reverse on that ground, and it could also reverse on the fact the blind have meaningful access. I mean, just looking at the record, as plaintiffs themselves admit in their deposition, they use the currency all the time. Over a two-month period, each of the two named plaintiffs use the currency 60 to 70 times. That means, on average, they use it at least once a day. And there's almost no evidence of fraud, so they use it successfully, they use it easily. And their experiences are not aberrational. The National Federation of the Blind...
We'll give you some time on rebuttal.
Okay. Wait. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Scott Labar, here today on behalf of the 50,000-plus members of the National Federation of the Blind. And we appreciate the opportunity to address the court on this important issue. The blind of this nation, the blind and visually impaired, do indeed have meaningful access to this nation's currency, as this concept of meaningful access under Section 504 is defined. This idea of meaningful access really comes from the notion that the government operates a program or funds an activity. And what we need to do, I believe, Your Honors, is look at what this currency activity really is. Is it just simply holding the bill and being able to look at it and understand what the written symbols mean on it? Is that the program or activity? Or, rather, is it the fact that this piece of paper that is the subject of this litigation, is it a part of a broader program or activity known as participating in the economy, participating in commerce? And with respect to that, Your Honors, the blind successfully have meaningful access to the participation in our nation's commerce and currency. And as the plaintiffs identify themselves and as the government has pointed out, they have demonstrated that they do not lack meaningful access to that activity. You know, the problem with all of this, Your Honors, is the fact is that no law, no regulation can make a blind person see. So by that very definition, the blind will never have equal access because no law or regulation can make me see the bill, can make me see the postage stamp, can make me see the federal building or whatever the case might be. However, is the government doing something that is barring me barring a blind person from participating fully or at least meaningfully in the activity. And in the case of U.S. currency, the government is not doing that. The government is, in fact, Your Honors, we believe, working hard to find a way to ultimately make currency more distinguishable in a non-visual manner. However, the current program does not bar or restrict blind people from participating in our nation's economy. It's all, I think, Your Honors, a matter, it's sort of a continuum. What are the biggest issues? What are the biggest problems? This particular issue, access to the ability to know what a bill is not the biggest issue or even close to one of the biggest issues faced by the blind. The blind of this nation are among the nation's poorest people. The kind of access to currency we need, Your Honors, is more of the currency in our hands.
Well, would you not agree that people may differ with the position you take, and that one of the arguments is that by not having a form of currency that enables the type of use, blind people cannot get certain entry-level jobs?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think that is a valid argument, because in the case of getting these jobs, if the issue is handling currency, the employer is under an obligation to provide reasonable accommodations, and reasonable accommodations can be provided that would allow a blind person to handle a job like that. For example, these bill readers that we've heard so much about. Your Honors, there are over about 3,000 blind men and women participating in the Randolph Shepherd program in this country, which is an entrepreneurial program. They handle cash all the time, and they use bill readers to handle those transactions. So I think that argument doesn't work. The fact that the currency is not readily distinguishable is not barring blind people from those kinds of entry-level jobs. It's the stereotypes and attitudes about blindness that often bar entrance to those kinds of jobs and create the unemployment rate for the blind that currently exists. And one other point I'd like to make to the court, because I know I only have a couple minutes here, is that...
You have no time.
I have no time. Well,
you can make your point.
I'll just make this point, and that is 504 does not authorize or spell out specific relief in a lot of situations, and in situations where it doesn't, organizations, individuals can go to the Congress for more specific relief. There's all kinds of examples of that in our brief and in the government's brief. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Honor, and may it please the Court. We respectfully submit that at the core and at the essence of using currency is the ability to contemporaneously verify at the time of the exchange that the amount of the currency exchanged is correct. That contemporaneous verification is at the essence and at the core of the ability to use currency to provide equivalent access. And if that were not enough, the Secretary has admitted in this case on the pleadings that the blind are less likely to detect errors in currency transactions. The Secretary has admitted on the pleadings in this case that the blind are at a distinct disadvantage in the event of a dispute as to the amount of currency exchanged. This case is different from the case in Alexander v. Choate. In Alexander v. Choate, the Supreme Court held a 14-day Medicaid inpatient limitation was applicable across the board to both disabled and non-disabled people. In the present case, the Secretary admits that the blind do not have equivalent access to currency as do the sighted individuals.
What is the relief you're seeking? I was puzzled in your red brief at 56 and 57. You say you're asking for the Secretary to conduct a thorough analysis. Is that all you want?
Yes, more or less. With respect, Your Honor, specifically.
So how would we write that opinion if we agreed with you?
Well, obviously, Judge Robertson didn't agree with me. He didn't grant that relief. But nonetheless, having said that, Your Honor, we had requested the court to provide order two things. One, a large denomination numeral, 40% of the banknote height, for the benefit of people with low vision, and for the benefit of the people who are totally blind, we felt that we are not in a position to make judgments on behalf of the Secretary. Recognizing the Secretary has broad discretion with respect to the design of currency, we are not in a position, we lack the expertise, quite frankly, to mandate any specific feature to currency. So we never sought that relief.
So you don't know whether any of these would, in fact, constitute an undue burden?
What we know is, on this record, none of the accommodations that were proposed on this record demonstrate an undue burden.
Even changing the size of the currency?
Well, that would clearly be the most expensive. That would clearly, but the problem with the government's undue burden analysis is that while they submit cost on the low end and on the high end, there's no effort to make a determination as to exactly how those costs would impact the mission of the agency. The cost figures are stated, but no analysis is made as to the impact of those cost figures.
Can I understand your answer to Judge Griffith? If the only relief you're seeking is a thorough analysis by the Secretary, and the Secretary has all these various studies going on, why isn't this case moot?
The problem is, Your Honor, that this issue has been for... The problem is, quite frankly, the Secretary hasn't done that thorough analysis.
Well, so you want to define the nature of the analysis?
Well, it's quite evident. We had proposed four features which could be used, essentially. Raised intaglio print, perforation, embossing.
No, but what I'm trying to focus on is if that's the only relief, and the Secretary has done some studies, others are underway, how can a court get in the middle of that? I mean, the Secretary understands there's an issue, is looking into it, hasn't come up with the answer that you would prefer so far. But if that's all you want the Secretary to do,
I
literally don't understand why the case isn't moving.
Well, actually, Your Honor, what we had asked the Secretary to submit was a corrective action plan, but I think more to the essence of your point here, the problem is the Secretary hasn't made a good faith effort to address the problem. That's really the problem at its essence.
What evidence do we have of that?
Well, for example, they said that they tested the Canadian feature to make a determination as to whether or not it was feasible. And in fact, it turns out that they sent 10 banknotes to Canada when they admit a 1,000 banknotes would be required to conduct a statistically significant test. And then they didn't furnish the report to us as the results of that report.
But do you understand what my concern here is that the Secretary makes a decision to send 10 rather than 1,000 and is satisfied that the 10 show that the tactile feature, there are serious problems with it. And so that's not something the Secretary decides he wants to pursue.
Well, I would grant you, Your Honor, if it comes to the point where the Secretary, after a good faith review, makes the determination that nothing is feasible, then that would be a situation we would look at that on that record. But that is not the case on this record.
Done some things recently with design. It's an ongoing activity. I'm just not clear about that.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor. The relief specifically we requested was the submission of a corrective action plan by the Secretary. That was the relief we submitted. Now, if the Secretary in that corrective action plan were to state, you know, we have looked at this issue, and we don't think it's feasible for one reason or another, security reason, technical reasons, cost reasons, any number of reasons. You know, that on that record, that may present a different set of a situation. But on this record, the Secretary has not made a good faith effort to look at the alternatives.
So you would want the court to find that? Matter of law that the Secretary has not made a good
I think the inference is quite plainly there, Your Honor. If in the Swiss feature, when they said that they were going to test it to make a determination as to whether it was feasible, once again, they sent 10 banknotes. They did not conduct a statistically significant test of 1,000 banknotes. The Secretary can point to very little they have done. This problem has been going on for...
They've been studying this for a while. This isn't a new issue, and there have been a number of studies that we've cited to in the extensive record. Isn't the inference instead that the Secretary is banking on the idea, pardon the pun, is banking on the idea that technology will be developed to make readers accessible? It seems to me that's the policy that they're pursuing.
Well, they haven't. Why
is that illegal for them to make that judgment?
That may be. They haven't said that, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. That may be what they're.
You
banking.
Want them to say it. So what you want them to do is you want a piece of paper where they say this is our position.
Well, I would say this, Your Honor. Clearly the technology in the banknote readers is not there today. I mean, it's just that's clearly the case. Now, if it is there. Clearly, the technology on the banknote readers is not there today to provide equivalent access.
What happened to What happened to the $35 prototype that they were investigating?
I've never heard, Your Honor, of that.
I've never.
Heard. Oh, the $35 prototype. I'm sorry. Yeah, the Secretary said on that they were unable to develop a workable machine. And of course, the other thing of that, I believe that the National Federation of the Blind has indicated they know of a $3,500 machine. Right. But that's obviously not affordable. Now,
imagine the day is going to come, or am I just too optimistic about technology, where there will be an electronic reader that will be reasonably priced?
Only if the government, in my opinion, is willing to subsidize the cost of it, because that's how they would develop a market. And the government has said they will not subsidize the cost. They have that's on the record of this case. That the government has said that they will not subsidize the cost of such a reader. That's at 556. Of the Joint Appendix.
How do you distinguish the other programs that I mentioned to Mr. Cohn? Postage stamps, websites, government publications, anything. The National Gallery now has a Hopper exhibit. They're all paintings. Is that a violation of the Rehabilitation Act?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor, because in paintings I can't think of a means to make them readily accessible to people without...
How about postage stamps?
Possibly.
How about websites?
Possibly. In fact, I think that would be covered under Section 508 of the Rehabilitation Act.
What is 508?
508 requires that government electronic information technology be made accessible to people with visual disabilities.
Information technology?
Such as websites. Correct.
I didn't think a website was technology.
I think that's the standards applied by the government, but... You know, I'd also like to respond to the statement, you know, if I may, that they state my clients use cash. What their testimony was, they prefer to use cash as opposed to credit cards for small purchases such as buying a cup of coffee. And there's some very good reasons for that. I mean, if one buys, when a blind person uses a credit card, they can't see the amount being charged. In addition to that, they go into debt every single time they make a purchase. In addition to that, many, many merchants do not accept credit cards, particularly for small purchases. An example of that is the courthouse cafeteria here. I was just down there today. They have a $5 minimum for credit card purchases. So that statement can be explained essentially on the basis they're not talking about that statement was not a brief for accessibility. In fact, that of currency. In fact, it was to reflect upon the disadvantages of using credit cards. And I may add also with respect to the note tellers, if the government were serious with respect to the whether note tellers provided a meaningful alternative, I would suggest that what they would have done is tested the note tellers with blind users as opposed to with a sighted paralegal at the Department of Justice. She describes a process by which she puts in the currency into a slot, and then while the money is going into a slot, it reads 2 seconds later the denomination. But I would suggest that for a blind person, that process may not be quite as facile as it is for a sighted individual.
Can I just return to something we discussed earlier? When this case was presented to the district court, you filed a complaint that prayed for certain relief. And that relief was not that the Treasury do a study. You requested some very specific things from the district court.
We did, Your Honor. We originally...
Now, are you telling this court that notwithstanding the prayer for relief in your complaint, that the only relief you seek in this case is for the Secretary of the Treasury to do a thorough study?
What we're seeking essentially is three things from the complaint. One, the use of a larger denominational numeral, at least 40...
Counsel, let's be very clear about this. Do you understand what I'm talking about? Your complaint prays to the court that you want a declaratory judgment.
Correct.
That you want a permanent injunction.
Correct.
Prohibiting the Secretary.
Correct, Your Honor.
From continuing to manufacture.
Correct.
Banknotes. I mean, that's a very different order than asking the Secretary to do a study.
Well, let me be...
That's what I need to understand. Are you abandoning all that and just telling us the only relief that is sought is a study?
No. Let me say this, Your Honor. With respect to the permanent injunction, our position in this litigation is that with respect to persons who are totally blind, it is not appropriate for the court to order a specific feature, any specific feature on currency. That has been our position in this litigation. With respect to note tellers, our position has been that the government is obligated to work towards the development of a note teller which would be reliable. And with
so are you saying that your prayer for relief, as stated in the complaint, is not a justiciable prayer? Not a justiciable claim?
I'm this issue of justiciability has not been raised in the briefs, and I'm a little bit at a loss.
What issue has not been raised?
The justiciability issue has not been raised in the briefs.
I understand that, but, and I may be putting you at a disadvantage, and I apologize for that, but I need to understand
right.
what we're dealing with here. That's,
right.
that's why I'm pursuing the question.
Right.
You answered, I believe, to Judge Griffith, that all you're seeking is for the Secretary to do a study. And you're explaining now to me that when you asked for a permanent injunction, you did that fully understanding that it was not appropriate for the court to interfere, as it were, with the Secretary's discretion.
The permanent injunction, Your Honor, I think was more intended to apply to the feature, to require the Secretary to use a specific feature for people with low vision, and that is a banknote that's at least a large denomination numeral that's at least 40% of the banknote height. That was what I would think the sense of that specific part of the prayer for relief is. With respect to the note teller, I've stated that. And again, with respect to the feature for a totally blind, our position is the submission of a corrective action plan. Now, with respect to I would also point out, if I may, that the Secretary's own regulations state that Section 504 is applicable to, quote, anything the agency does, end quote. And that anything means anything. So essentially, the Secretary cannot dispute, by virtue of their own regulations, that the design and production of currency is not subject to the provisions of the Rehabilitation Act. And with respect to and there is no conflict, I may add. The Secretary has identified no conflict on this record between his obligations to design currency in a way which is a...
But isn't the implication of some of our questions that because currency is so pervasive and the program is so big, that given the Supreme Court's acknowledgement that there are these two conflicting interests that have to keep the act within some measure of reasonableness here?
I think the analytical framework for analyzing Section 504 claims is the regulations. The regulations state, essentially, they go through an analytical process by which Section 504 claims should be reviewed and adjudicated. Now, the Supreme Court in manageable bounds made perfect sense in the court of that decision, because essentially the disabled in that case had said, well, what we want is more, because we're disabled, we need more than 14 days. And the Supreme Court said, inpatient care. And the Supreme Court said in that case, well, that would require the court to go in and review each type of person to determine whether or not they actually needed more than 14 days. And essentially, that program becomes unmanageable. Here, we're seeking a single feature. We're not seeking an individualized assessment. We're seeking a single feature which could be used by the blind.
If the inquiry that falls upon us is to try and determine whether Congress in the Rehabilitation Act spoke to this issue, mandated what you're arguing, what are we to make of the fact that Congress has had many opportunities since the Rehab Act to do precisely what you're asking us to do now, and Congress has said no? Why can't we see this as an attempt to end run around the political process that hasn't granted you the relief you want? Instead, you're going to the courts to ask us to do that. Which,
because
obviously, if that's the way I phrased it, we wouldn't be inclined to do that.
Because if, in fact, the Rehabilitation Act is applicable to anything the agency does, as is stated in the preamble to the agency's regulations, which I may add is a model prototype of the preamble, which is used by the Department of Justice as a government-wide prototype, if, in fact, that's the case, then it is actionable under Section 504. And the government...
There's a disconnect, though, this statute is not a model of clarity, by the way. If you... The definition of... The operative words are program or activity.
Correct. Correct.
And if you look at the definition of program or activity, it does not include operations of the Department of the Treasury. It deals with state and local governments, colleges and universities, and things of that sort. So right away, we've got a definitional problem in the statute. But beyond that, the activity that you claim triggers the act is not an activity of the federal government. If you are down in our cafeteria spending a dollar bill, that is not a federal activity and is not a federal program. What you're complaining about is the manufacture of the bill that is used in an activity that you claim is a violation of Section 504, and that's a disconnect. And do you know of any other cases where there's a comparable and analogous situation? Because I haven't found any.
Well, first, Your Honor, let me say with respect to the issue of programmer activity, Judge Robertson was similarly troubled. And he, in fact, asked the parties to brief the issue. We did. We briefed the issue in our August 31st, 2005 motion for summary judgment, in which we said that, in fact, the design and production of currency was a program or activity within the meaning of the Section 504. The Department of Justice declined to brief the issue. They just said they would not brief the issue. With respect to the issue the second issue, I would simply state that the problem...
So can I interrupt? So what is the argument that it's a program or activity under definition?
We made the argument. The argument essentially what we did in that brief, which was, as I said, filed in our earlier memorandum, is we looked at the regulations. The regulations said that it's applicable to anything the agency does.
Well, I'm looking at the statute and the definition that that Judge Randolph just pointed to. Where in the language of the statute is currency of the national government?
The statute is not a model of clarity. You're absolutely right. The statute,
so it's not there.
It is it's just not a model of clarity. I mean, there's just no question
more than
about
that.
Granted,
few statutes are models of clarity.
Right. This one is particularly not a model of clarity.
Subsection A gives, subsection B takes away.
In a sense, it's not a model of clarity. And you know, I mean, it's ambiguous, Your Honor. I would be the first.
Okay, what's the ambiguity? Where's the language in B that suggests that it applies to the currency?
Because
if it's ambiguous, there's got to be some reference.
Because essentially in A, it says it's applicable to any program or activity of an executive agency. In B, they go ahead, as Judge Randolph said, and they kind of take that away. And so it's an ambiguous statute. And that's why under Skidmore, under Chevron.
You're relying on A.
Right.
There's nothing in B to help you.
And under Chevron or Skidmore, one would normally look at the regulations to sort of fill in the interstices of the statute. Lastly, Your Honor, I would simply say that I request that the judgment of the district court be affirmed. Thank you, Your
Thanks.
Honor.
I think Mr. Cohn is out of time. We'll give you 2 minutes.
Your Honor, the views of the American Council of the Blind are extremely important to the Secretary of the Treasury and the Bureau of Engraving and Printing, and will continue to take their views into account as we explore future ways to redesign the currency. But that is completely separate from the question of whether or not there's a violation under the Rehabilitation Act. As Judge Griffith pointed out a few moments ago, Congress has repeatedly declined to require particular changes to the currency. Instead, Congress left in place 12 U.S.C. 418, which leaves the design of the currency in the discretion of the Secretary of the Treasury. Unless this Court has further questions, I'd be happy to rest on the briefs.
I want to be clear that I think I have your answer, but that the government relied upon the evidence that NFB submitted, or not that NAMA submitted regarding the effect on the private sector?
In district court, correct. They submitted a brief as well, and we presented their argument. They presented their argument.
Did the government oppose the or claim that there were material facts in dispute in opposing the American Council's summary judgment motion?
We opposed their motion, but we also filed our own motion.
But did you oppose it on the basis that there were material facts in dispute?
I think not. I think our position was simply that there are no material facts and the Court should grant us summary judgment.
For your motion?
For our motion. They should
but
grant our motion.
What about for their motion?
I could double-check. I don't think we said there are genuine issues, material fact remaining.
They had to submit a Rule 7.1 statement of material facts not in dispute.
We did dispute.
According to the local rules, right?
That's correct. And we did dispute many of their statements that facts were undisputed, but I could double check, but I think our bottom line was that the Court should just grant our I might be incorrect about that, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Case is submitted.